Are you keeping up with the revolution in value? We're just beginning to realize that all value is formed in the customer's domain. The responsibility of entrepreneurs is to facilitate that value, to help customers to realize value, to experience value, and they're doing it faster, with greater efficiency, and more innovation. Stephen Denning explains.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. At Economics for Entrepreneurs, we're building a strong bridge between Austrian economics and business success by demonstrating how economic principles can be applied effectively to establish uniquely differentiated and competitively advantaged businesses that reap marketplace rewards to a disproportionate degree. Recently, for example, we talked to Rick Rule, who applied principles of Austrian business cycle theory and Austrian price theory in corporate finance for mid-sized companies in raw materials markets, a field which is notoriously cyclical and where price fluctuations can be scary for the uninitiated and the underinformed investor. Rick's knowledgeable application of Austrian economics helped him become a leader in his field and helped his business to grow dramatically. A couple of weeks ago, we talked with Dr. Byland about how Austrian economics is expressed in the bundle of business management practices that go by the name of Agile. These Agile practices, stressing decentralization of decision-making in small teams, customer sovereignty, and networks over hierarchies, for example, are applications of Austrian principles, such as the dynamically flexible allocation of capital and the power of compounding distributed knowledge into shared insights. Dr. Byland admired the responsiveness of agile firms to continuous and unpredictable changes in customer preferences, but he also wondered whether the agile practices should go further. Successful entrepreneurs imagine the future and the customer's future preferences rather than respond to them in the present. When an entrepreneur is designing an offering to make a customer's life better in the future, responding to current needs is insufficient. It doesn't reduce the uncertainty. So it seems that we should examine agile practices and their usefulness for entrepreneurs a little bit more closely. Fortunately, we have an unparalleled opportunity to do so, because we have with us today Stephen Denning. Stephen writes about Agile for Forbes and has done so for many years, meaning he has been investigating, interviewing practitioners and management executives, and observing Agile application and execution for a long time. He knows his stuff. His book, The Age of Agile, was published by HarperCollins in 2018 and was selected by the Financial Times as one of the best business books of the year. Stephen consults with organizations around the world on leadership, innovation, management, and business narrative. For many years, he worked at the World Bank, where he held important management positions, including Director of Knowledge Management. He is currently a director of the SD Learning Consortium, and he's also the author of The Leader's Guide to Radical Management, The Leader's Guide to Storytelling, and The Secret Language of Leadership. Stephen, hello.
Hi, Hunter.
Welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Happy to be here.
We're talking today about Agile, which we've actually covered a little bit before at E4E. It's a set of management practices and radical organizational principles. I've called you the leading expert, Steve, which I think is fair. You wrote the book, The Age of Agile. And that was a 2018 book. It was a business book of the year with the Financial Times. And you talked about a revolution in how organizations are being run, how they're connecting everyone and everything, connecting all places all the time. And you talk about instant, intimate, frictionless value on a large scale. we're now in 2019. So maybe a good place to start would be to give us the view from 2019, Steve. How is the revolution progressing, and what state is it? And is it meeting the, you know, some of the great visions that you have for it?
Well, the revolution's almost over. You might say that the world has embraced it, and 90% of senior executives want to be agile, even if less than 10% are agile. There's a recognition that this is really the only way to manage an organization in the 21st century. So far from being a radical idea, this is now mainstream. People who are doing top-down bureaucracy are really the radical people in today's world. This is basically the revolution's over, and they declare victory. And if you're not in this mode, you're not going to have much of a future as an organization. Because as you mentioned, it is now possible for any personal thing to connect with any other personal thing at zero cost and instantly all around the world. So basically everything that human beings do is being reinvented. And unless you are in this mode, you will not be able to move fast enough to keep pace with this reinvention, which is happening on a daily, on an hourly basis.
Well, we'll touch on some of the core concepts, Steve, but that's a dramatic statement. But let's pause the math that you mentioned there. You said in surveys, 90% want to be agile, but 10% are. I think that was the benchmark.
So right.
Why is that? What's the difference between intent and achievement?
Well, firms are entrenched bureaucratic attitudes and values and practices and systems and processes and structures, and all of those things take a long time to dismantle and put in place the new attitudes and values and processes and systems and structures. And so big organizations are certainly struggling. Some are very well advanced, and some of the fastest and largest growing firms on the planet, like Amazon and Microsoft and Netflix and firms like that, are very well advanced and have been doing it for a number of years. But other firms are still either in denial or unable to change their values and structures and systems. And so they are trundling along, unable to adapt fast enough to the marketplace.
Is that a function of age of these firms, Steve, or the businesses they're in? I can imagine it's harder for GE, say, than it is Amazon, given where GE started and what condition they're in. Is that the key?
Well, certainly if you have a century of entrenched attitudes and values, that can be a handicap. But some firms, as I say, have made the transition. I mean, Microsoft is not a young firm and has made the transition. And some young firms, Blockbuster and others, weren't able to make the turn. So it's not really a question of age now. It's a question of mindset at the top of the organization, a realization that the world has changed, and so organizations and management needs to change, and then taking the necessary steps to make the change. And it isn't quick, it isn't easy, and it needs determination and grit and a different mindset that it's possible. We've seen it done, and the rewards for doing it are enormous. That's why firms like Amazon and Agile and Facebook and Google are so highly valued, and why firms like GE and let's say IBM, who haven't been able to make the turn, are much less valued.
Well, we're interested in the economics of Agile, Steve, and I'm going to break down some of the economic concepts and place them in the Agile context and see if we're thinking in the right way. So the first one is work, and you say prominently at the beginning of the book, Agile is about getting more value from less work, and that's pretty exciting and pretty fundamental economic concept to do with efficiency and productivity and the disutility of work. So can you delve into that a little bit? Is it more digital work and less human work, or is it a big change in the ratio of value that firms can get from work? Please tell us more about that.
Part of it is the shift to digital, in the sense that it used to be quite a hassle to buy a product. You have to get out of your house and into your car and go to the shop and buy something and pay for it, wait for it, and then you get it, and then you drive home, and if you're lucky, and you've got it. And now you simply go online and boom, it's done. Digital certainly speeds up everything. So that's one part of it. But the other part is that when you look at these big organizations, large proportion of what they're doing is not adding value to any customer and can be replaced by processes that are much simpler and faster and do add value to customers. So you're looking at elimination of, in the agile world, we have over drinks estimates of how much is the amount of waste in these big organizations, and it's usually somewhere well over 20% and sometimes well over 50%. And I don't know what the right figure is, but it's a huge number that you look around at these organizations, just large proportion of the things that people are doing are not adding value to customers and so can be eliminated.
That's a good analysis. But just from my understanding, you described a situation where the customer who buys something doesn't have to leave the house. They just have to click the digital button. But then the UPS driver has to go to the Amazon warehouse and pick it up and drive to my house and so on. So is the net amount of work lower, or are we just shifting it?
Well, certainly it's faster. And you're eliminating a lot of waste in that transaction. But the real saving is, I think, in the elimination of work within the organization. But these big bureaucracies are just incredibly inefficient and waste everywhere you look.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned time there, and time is another fundamentally important element of economics. We always struggle with it because production takes time. And while you're producing, the marketplace might be changing and you might be producing the wrong thing. So there's a lot of uncertainty and, as you say, waste in there. You said in your book that agile companies use time as a strategic weapon. So that's another one I'd like you to expand on, is how does time become a strategic weapon?
Well, it's pretty simple. If Amazon can deliver something the next day, you're going to look at a firm that delivers in a week or 2 weeks or a month in a rather unfavorable light. And the Amazon is obviously taking advantage of their speed as a competitive weapon. That would be the most obvious case.
So speed adds.
And so other firms catching up. I mean, they are doing it on a global scale. I mean, to think of, if they're just doing it in one village or something, but they're doing it on a global scale. And so firms like Walmart, big as they are, simply are facing already way behind and will be very difficult for them to catch up.
Yeah, so speed adds value is what you're saying. It's
I like speed. I haven't met a customer who doesn't want things rapidly.
<Yep. laughs>
If you know of any, I'd like to meet them.
Yeah, good point. So analyzing what people really want is part of it. The law that we're most comfortable with of the three laws of agile that you lay out in the book, Stephen, is the law of the customer. And economists think they knew that. They talk about customer sovereignty, the idea that the customer decides who wins in the marketplace by buying and not buying. And if you can include them in the production process by asking them early to comment on designs and minimum viable products and that kind of thing, that's a benefit. So does that capture the law of the customer, do you think, or is the law of the customer much deeper and broader?
That's much deeper and broader. I mean, most of economics is concerned with commodities. And so customer has a commodity, and so it goes for the cheaper price, and so the customer is king, the customer is sovereign. That is a a sliver of the modern economy, where commodities are simply not a major factor in the consumer world anyway. And the customer now is looking at everything is in terms of does it meet my needs? I mean, they assume that the car will be a perfect driving machine, but is it responsive when I tell the car where would I go to get gasoline, or where is the nearest Starbucks, or what's the quickest route to Los Angeles? Or in a hotel room, now a customer wants to be able to walk into the room, and instead of having to fiddle with the thermostat and fiddle with the TV and fiddle with the controls to say, I want the room at 71 degrees, I want my favorite channel, I want my favorite club sandwich brought to my room with a glass of wine, and don't bother me after that. The customer expects now these kinds of things. And obviously in hotels, they rarely get it at this point, but that's what's coming. And firms that can deal with that and respond to it will survive, and those that can't won't. And so that's happening. Every product customers are demanding and getting this kind of responsiveness. And this is a fundamental shift from a world in which firms delivered products where you could predict what the product was. You could build a car. It could be the perfect machine. And that was enough. If it would drove perfectly and lasted for a long time, that was good enough. Now you are dealing with customer experiences. And this is a shift from a linear phenomenon to a complex phenomenon. And so suddenly perfection is no longer possible. Now you cannot plan exactly what it is customers want. You can only find it out by experimentation and interaction, and it changes rapidly. And so you need to be able to respond as the experience changes. And the customer experiences what you're offering, and then they say, oh, that's great, now I want something else. And oh, actually, I didn't like that. And something you're doing is annoying me, so please stop that. And firms that cannot respond to that are in trouble. So it's a different world and different mindset and a different capability. And firms that haven't grasped this are simply not going to be around.
Yep. You have to give us a little bit more credit, Steve. We understand what we call subjective value, which is what's going on in the mind of the customer, as you so fluently described there. And it's subjective. It varies by the customer and occasion and the emotions that they're feeling and so on like that. One of the places where we're trying to advance theory is from something called co-creation of value, which came up in research a few years ago that you expose ideas to the customer, they give you a reaction, and you observe how they deal with them, so they're part of the process, to the idea that I think you've just described, which is all the value is in the domain of the customer. The customer decides entirely what is value, and the entrepreneur or the firm can only facilitate. Are we starting to go in the right direction when we think like that?
Well, I would say that's partially correct. I mean, the reality is that the customer cannot imagine what the technology can do. So no customer was asking Steve Jobs to put 1,000 songs in their pocket. No customer was demanding Steve Jobs to build a microcomputer that could do 1,000 different things that would be tremendously useful. So the customer has certain wants and needs, but cannot visualize what the technology might be able to do. So I think it's a mistake to think, as it was a mistake to think that the firm was providing the value, it's equally a mistake to think that the customer is the sole determinant of the value. The customer is the sole determinant of whether he'll pay for what is produced, but it is a co-creation process. And I think any attempt to say otherwise, I think, is misunderstanding the thing. And it is true that when you're delivering some new product or service, the the most common competitor that a firm has to deal with is that the customer will do nothing. The customer will simply prefer to live in their mediocrity and not pay money for the whatever product or service that you're offering. And so that's certainly true. There's the customer is sovereign in that respect, but the customer cannot by themselves know what they need in advance because they cannot visualize what the technology can do. So it's the combination of the two which is driving the phenomenon.
That's a fascinating area to try to push on. We say that the job of the entrepreneur or the innovator or the technologist is to imagine the future, imagine what the customer might be able to do with the technology. There's a lot of error in that. Obviously, imagination is a lot of uncertainty. But that's what we describe as the job of the entrepreneur. Is that inaccurate? We can't even imagine what that future might be.
Well, I'm a big fan of Kurt Carlson's four-step NEBC approach, where the entrepreneur starts with the need of the customer and tries to imagine what the need of the customer is, and then experiments step by step and try to get an assessment of the scope of the need, the range of the need, the depth of the need. So that's the need. And then there's the approach. What approach does the firm have that might be able to respond to that need? And does the approach have an aspect that gives the firm some kind of competitive advantage, some kind of a unique way of meeting that need? And then looking at the benefits for the eventual customer and the benefits for the firm itself and the cost for the customer and the cost for the firm, that's B, and then C, the competition. And in particular, is there anyone else already meeting this need? And if not, is the customer willing to actually do something? As I say, the key competition is usually that the customer will do nothing. The customer will look at this thing and say, well, thanks a lot, but I'm going to live on in my mediocrity. And even though it's a brilliant idea, good luck, it's not for me. And so that is the process by which entrepreneurs need to address the question. So it's a process, and both the firm and the entrepreneur and the customer are involved in it. And that co-creation process, if it goes well, will lead to a profitable product that meets customers' needs, and they'll be thrilled and delighted and tell all their friends about it.
Yeah, Kurt was a guest in our program a few weeks ago, and we've shared the NABC process with listeners, and we're big fans of it. We just struggle a little bit with the vocabulary of the traditional vocabulary, Steve, of adding value and creating value and delivering value. You have a term in your book where you call it exploration as opposed to value creation. You talk about facilitating outcomes, and as you point out, the outcomes are not imaginable. So you're facilitating something as opposed to creating value. Is that better to say we're explorers?
There's a lot of nonsense talked about creating value. I was just reading a book today which was talking about delivering value, and it was obviously they weren't talking about anything that was adding anything to a customer. They were talking about things that in the imagination of the firm. So I agree with you that we need to be looking at things from the point of view of the customer and exploring it. And I mean, talking about needs, I think, is customers' needs. Talking about unmet needs of the customer, I think that's a useful way of. And if you can meet those unmet needs in a way that's at a reasonable cost, and it's important to the customer, and they're willing to get up out of their chair and actually buy the product or service, then yeah, the end result of that process is value. But I agree, talking about delivering value is usually there's something wrong in the scene if you're talking about delivering value. Although you'll probably find somewhere in my book I'll use that phrase, but that's a bad phrase to be using.
Well, you know, it's just hard to get used to the language change. I struggle with it myself. And so I'm noting a phrase that you just used, the end result of the process is value. That's a good way to think of it. But now, bear with me, Steve, in the spirit of exploration here. I'm a marketer. I've been a marketer all of my career, and we grew up thinking about customer needs, that we could identify needs. It's an old, old idea. It's Maslowian, I think, originally, that kind of hierarchy of needs idea. And I wonder whether even that word is redundant now. So if you paint this picture of the customer living this complex life, they live in an ecosystem of many services and many products and interaction with lots of people, and they evaluate this new invention or whatever the entrepreneur is offering to see if it fits into their life. And maybe they find that it does in ways that, as you said, we can't imagine. This idea of qualifying to fit into the customer's life is a bit different from meeting needs. So would you encourage us to find another term than needs?
No, I think I wouldn't. I think you start off by exploring, is there something that the customer theoretically might need but is not being met? So customers, let's say, pre-2002, did not perceive that they had a need for having 1,000 songs in their pocket. But after they had discovered that it was possible, then suddenly they felt that need. So I think the fact that they did find it valuable and they found the approach to meeting that need useful and even delightful, and they found the cost was reasonable, and they found it was worthwhile getting up out of their chair and actually buying an iPod and downloading songs. That whole process generated value. So I'm not putting all the weight on need, but I think that it's that process that the end result is value for the customer and value for the firm. And economic value for the firm and delight for the customer.
Okay, I'm going to make just one more push. The value for the customer is inherent in the 1,000 songs, Stephen, but it's really formed when I create my own playlist, is it not? And I can combine different songs that I want and different performance that I want, and it becomes mine. It becomes perfectly customized. And I can wrap my head around the idea of customization, which is done by the customer, as the place where value is formed.
Well, I mean, you start out with the 1,000 songs in the pocket, and then you start to say, well, there are further things we could do. We could show you how to join the things together and form a playlist. And then Spotify comes along and says, hey, we can actually every week send you 30 new songs you've never heard of before that are going to thrill you. And, oh, wow, that's cool. Things that you never imagined were possible become possible and suddenly become needs. I mean, if Spotify were to go out of business and I wasn't to get my Discover Weekly playlist every Monday, I would be very upset. And so it's become a need, but it certainly wasn't a need before my daughter told me to join Spotify.
Right. I hope you feel as excited as I do listening to Steve Denning illustrating the Austrian market process using Spotify as an example. Consumers have a feeling, at best only lightly articulated, that they'd like mobile, on-demand, digital music, but they don't know what's possible. Spotify comes along with 1,000 songs in your pocket, and consumers are delighted. That's what I wanted. And then Spotify goes further with a weekly release of new songs. Consumers couldn't have imagined that in advance, but Spotify could, and they turned the impossible to imagine into a need and a value experience and a business model. If you'd like to find out about the Austrian market process, try our Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey online course at e4epod.com/journey. We take you through the market process from the entrepreneur's perspective and provide tools you can use, including how to identify consumers' unarticulated subjective value cravings. That's e4epod.com/journey. The letter E, the number 4, the letter E, pod.com/journey. And now back to our conversation. Okay, there's a method that you talk about in the book to help firms, help entrepreneurs get into a position, I guess, where they can imagine some of this innovation and be agile in trying to facilitate it. And it's customer anthropology. I don't know whether that's an official term, but it came up in one of your case studies. It was about getting out there in the customer's world, understanding people, understanding their environment, their workflow, their habits, their fears, their dreams, and then trying to design an experience that they would like. Is customer anthropology part of Agile? Is that something we should be learning to do?
Well, there is no official Agile. There is no Académie Française that is declaring what is mm-hmm. It's like the English language. What is the English language? It's what people do. And that is what Menlo Innovations and Rich Sheridan does. I mean, he saw this was an essential thing that needed to be done, and so he recruited anthropologists to do that instead of going to Africa and sort of studying tribes or something. Go into farms and into customers' homes and find out what was driving them. And obviously, other firms do it in a different way. I mean, Apple, Steve Jobs famously did it himself. He imagined he was the anthropologist for Apple. He imagined what customers needed. He didn't conduct focus groups. He didn't go out and talk to people. He just sat and imagined what it was that they needed, and turned out he was right. They did what he imagined they needed, they actually wanted. And so different firms do it in different ways. And I think what Rich is doing is great. What Steve Jobs did, if you have a Steve Jobs, then obviously, yeah, he's worth $1 trillion, it turns out. But many firms don't have a Steve Jobs, so then they recruit anthropologists or recruit market experts or people who can figure out what it is that's driving people and what's important in their lives and what isn't, and how could we help them, and how could we avoid not annoying them and trying to meet their needs and all of those things.
Yeah. As they're changing and wending their idiosyncratic way, I think you call it the twists and turns of customer preferences.
I mean, and this is, as I say, an emergent field. It's very complex and it's constantly changing. I mean, you had one car firm. I mean, they had this wonderful thing which gave weather warnings to drivers. So you're driving along and you get a warning, you're about to encounter a flood zone, so pay attention. And that sounded like a wonderful idea to do put in the car. And then they put it in the car. And then what they found is that couldn't turn it off, that they had forgotten to put a switch that would turn it off. So customers driving along and every 1 minute they're getting, you're about to enter a flood zone, do something. You're about to enter a flood zone, do something. Driving the customers mad. And so, so they had to turn the whole thing off. So, I mean, you do things that sound like they meet a need, and everyone says that meets a need, and everyone says they want it, but then you actually try it out in practice, and it has unexpected consequences. So it's not only that the customer is complex, the firm then has to have the complexity and the agility to adjust as they find out, that didn't work the way we wanted and expected, and so now we have to do it differently.
Yeah, we economists have a word that we use to try and capture that issue or that challenge, Steve, which is uncertainty. You you try to imagine the future, but you can't, and it's going to change even as you're trying to respond to it. You have an even better word, I think, or at least an acronym, which is VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, VUCA. And that's a very challenging kind of environment. Is it even possible to deal with VUCA? Have you seen companies that do it better than others? How do you respond to that, you know, that set of conditions?
Well, I didn't invent the term, of course, but this is our world. Welcome to our world. That's why agile is essential. That's why firms that aren't agile won't be able to cope, because the big lumbering bureaucracy where you're defining things in advance and then delivering that and finding out it doesn't fit, that simply isn't going to work anymore. So that's what agility is about, responding to a VUCA world.
And then a big impact of all of this is how firms are organized, Steve. And you say that corporations have to radically invent, or reinvent rather, how they're organized and led. And reading your book, you can pick up a number of very important principles. I included here individuals and interactions over processes and tools, and customer collaboration over contract negotiation, and responding to change over following a plan. You know, those kinds of contrasts. Mm-hmm. Is there a how-to of Agile to build your organization on those kinds of principles? I know you said there's no Académie Française and no handbook, but is there a way of organizing for Agile?
Well, those principles you mentioned are from the Agile Manifesto of 2001. And essentially what I think we've learned some things since 2001, and I tried to lay it out in my book. And basically I'm saying that it begins with a mindset to deal with this strange VUCA world we're in. It has three elements. This mindset has three elements. One, an obsession with creating great outcomes for customers. Secondly, a presumption that all work, to the extent possible, should be done by small teams working in short cycles, creating great outcomes for customers. And thirdly, that the organization operates not as a top-down command and control bureaucracy, but as a network where value and communications are flowing horizontally and upwards as well as down. Those are what we've learned over the last 17 years are the key core elements of the Agile movement, looking around the world based on at least my assessment of what are the core elements. Those are the core. And if you're doing all of those things, you can legitimately claim to be Agile. If you're only doing some of them or none of those things, you cannot really claim to be Agile. It's multiplicative, not additional. In other words, if you get a zero in any of those things, your total score is zero. You have to have the mindset and the obsession with customers and the small teams and the network. And if you have all those teams, then you're well on your way to coping with the VUCA world. If you don't have any one of those things, you're going to be in trouble. That's what we've learned, I still think, over the last 18 years since the Agile Manifesto.
One of the elements of the law of the network that we explore a lot is the idea of dynamically flexible capital structures, that you're constantly redeploying capital to respond to the customer and respond to the changes in the marketplace. And it's a piece of economic theory that is nice, but it's been really hard to see it executed in practice. Are you seeing that now? Are you seeing people be able to redeploy capital in that spontaneous, emergent, fast response kind of fashion?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the gist of Agile. That's the when it's done well, and that's what you see. I mean, I've written about it in Amazon, where they consistently just moving capital around based on what's happening in the market. And as some activities are increasingly valuable and perceived to be so, then resources are shifted to those, and other activities which are perceived to be less valuable are either reduced resources or closed down completely. And that is how Amazon, for instance, has created all of these new businesses over 20 years. Quite amazing, entering new fields by out of their existing businesses, new ideas crop up, which then create new businesses, and they are ruthless in closing down things that aren't working and pursuing ideas that are promising. So, for instance, their third party seller business, which is a huge part of their business. They tried it three times before they got it right. They tried it once, it didn't work, they closed it down. They tried it the second time, didn't work, closed it down, tried it the third time. Oh, finally it worked. So, okay, now it's part of the Amazon, huge part of their work. And the web services, now their most profitable business, was flowed out of their difficulties in coping with their own computer services, and they decided, if we have something that will work for us, it should work for the rest of the world. It turned out they were right, and so cloud computing became a huge thing and hugely profitable for Amazon.
It's almost hard, Steve, to think about a firm, if you've grown up in the old mental model of a firm, in this new agile way. You have this great visual analogy in your book that a firm is a flotilla of tiny speedboats, in contrast to a battleship or a machine or something like that. Elsewhere you call it an organism, but it can move in all these different directions. And it's hard to think of that as a firm as opposed to a set of projects or small teams. So is the idea of the firm changing entirely?
Absolutely. Discard your idea of the firm. Mm-hmm. Expunge it from your memory. do not save it in archive either. Just get rid of it. That is no longer there. The firm is a network, and leadership is taking place at all levels of the firm, and you are pushing decisions to wherever the information is closest to the having the best information. So if the information is close to the customer, it's that leadership and decision making is going to be close to the customer. And that, so you'll find in the book, there's that in the chapter four, I think it is, with General McChrystal, when he shifted from that sort of pyramid with he had agile teams sort of reporting upwards to a pyramid where basically, the teams had taken over the whole organization. Executives look at that diagram and are horrified. That is their worst nightmare because they cannot imagine a firm like that, organization like that could possibly be efficient. But it turns out if each of those teams is obsessed with delivering value for the firm and great outcomes for the customer, and has real-time metrics about how it's doing that, then it turns out that a firm like that is much more efficient and much more agile and much more productive than these lumbering top-down bureaucracies. So, as I say, you need to expunge all those images of pyramids they no longer fit the current world.
Yep. Discard the diagrams. Good.
Well, not discard all the diagrams, but embrace the new diagrams. Embrace these seemingly chaotic networks of teams and start to think through, well, how would we make that operational? And what you realize is that it is going to be chaos if, unless each of those teams is closely and tightly and obsessively focused on delivering great outcomes for customers and delivering value for the firm. And so having a metrics in place that enable that to happen, a key part of making making this happen. And I would say that this, of the three laws that I mentioned, I call them laws, but they're only half facetiously they're laws. They are crucial elements, but there's the customer and the small team and the network. But it's the network, this third law, that's the biggest stumbling block for most big organizations today. I mean, they can grasp the small teams, okay, small teams. They can grasp the obsession with customer. But then they come to the network, turning this top-down command and control bureaucracy into a network is that's where most of them are struggling.
One more concept from economics I just wanted to explore briefly is the concept of competition, which, you know, is sometimes portrayed as this kind of dog-eat-dog drive to the lowest cost, as you said. But if a firm is doing its anthropology with its customer, it's fitting into the customer's lives and ecosystem, customization is the result, there's a tight, tight bond there. Is competition really a relevant concept in this field of designing your firm?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the of the Kurt Carlson's NABC framework. That's the fourth element, competition. And yes, you have to be beating out the competition, and you have to have an approach. The second element, that is, where you have some kind of uniqueness, some kind of reason why your firm is able to deliver this in a way that other firms will find it difficult or either to catch up or to do the same thing. And if you don't, then yeah, someone else will deliver the same service, and suddenly you'll be just one firm among hundreds of firms delivering exactly the same thing, and you will not make very much money. So yeah, competition hasn't died. Competition is now increasingly fierce, and it's a, as you know, it's a winner take all market in many sectors, and so if you don't cope with the competition, you're going to have a short life.
One of the companies that you cited in a recent post, I think, Steve, was Toyota, and you said something interesting about them, that we've always looked at them as a tremendous model of kind of a lean process, decentralized authority at the bottom and so on like that. But you said that even they are changing their model of how they operate, and you called it from lean to flow. And so is Agile now leading to this idea of a flow model where you're in constant change, as opposed to the lean model where you're perfecting something that you've done before?
Well, they're not changing lean, they're building on lean. I mean, they were using lean to produce these very reliable, high quality cars at the lowest possible price, and that doesn't change. But what they have found is that everyone is now producing a reliable car at a low price, and the competition is now in the experience of the driver and the passengers. And so, can you communicate with the car? What sort of voice communication is available? Can you ask the car, where's the nearest Starbucks? Those are the kinds of things which are now being the... and those, as I say, you're in a different world. You're in a... Mm-hmm. The lean world was a predictable linear world. This is a complex world which cannot be determined in advance and needs to be continually updated. So you cannot have a system where the car is manufactured and then you don't see it for another 20 years. You need to be like Tesla, where you have the cars in connection with the firm so that they can make changes on a weekly basis if necessary to the car, without the car having to be brought into the repair shop. So what they've realized is that lean was not enough. It's not that it's wrong, it's just not enough. But now the marketplace has changed and we need others. So they're adding Agile on top of Lean, and so in one sense, it's a huge shock that after being regarded as the pinnacle of engineering and the best that manufacturing could be, to realize that now we have another mountain to climb. But I think what's exciting is that they are tackling it, they are dealing with it. They're not. I don't see any of the signs you see in some organizations where you see a lot of pushback and saying, "Well, we don't have to do this. It's not really." I mean, despite their impeccable reputation in manufacturing, they're embracing Agile in a very full-throated way, and so it's very impressive to see what they're up to.
Yeah, impressive and instructive. Let me touch on one more point in the time that we have remaining, Steve, and that is leadership. You've talked a lot about leadership. You've written a lot about leadership. You've studied it. In Agile, you talk about distributed leadership. Teams lead the organization. And then within the team, it's a function that's shared by all the team members and then all the teams between each other. But in a situation like Toyota, presumably somebody had to determine that we need to get beyond Lean into flow. So just tell us how to think about leadership in firms today.
Well, this is a subject on which probably more nonsense is talked about in management than any other. So Professor Kellerman at Harvard suggests that the $50 billion a year that firms are spending on leadership training is largely wasted. So there's certainly room for improvement. The central challenge of leadership that I've often seen is the ability to persuade people to embrace strange new ideas. And when you look at all these tens of thousands of leadership books, they are often have nothing to say on that subject. So I've written a number of books on leadership storytelling, which is one of the ways in which leaders can persuade people to embrace strange new ideas. So that's another area that is worthy of attention. And I think in the that is what's happening in firms like Toyota or in Microsoft, where someone comes across with the idea and is able to persuade first of all their colleagues and then the managers and then the senior managers and ultimately the top of the organization, this is the way we need to do things. And what we're seeing now is that a recognition that leadership needs to be as close as possible to the place where the information, the best information is. So leadership is shifting to the teams, that they are now increasingly being asked to say, well, what makes sense for this product or that service? Because they understand what it is, whereas the chief executive sitting thousands of miles away doesn't have a clue really what's going on in that context. So all of these things suggest that leadership is due for a big shakeup.
Have the business schools discovered Agile, and are they rethinking leadership? It's been a big product for them for the past 20 years.
I wish I could say that they were championing it. Northwestern University and one or two others are dabbling in it, but I wouldn't say that I'm aware of any significant embrace. It's actually been one of my big disappointments that I thought that the business schools would be one of the big supporters of this. And they have all these bright people, and they supposedly should be open to the best ideas. But by and large, I don't think that's the case. I think part of it is that these ideas came from the wrong people, as I've written about in my book. If ideas come from Harvard Business School or something, or they come from the Royal Society, then people should pay attention to these new ideas. But when the ideas come from low-level software developers, people with blue hair and earrings and wearing T-shirts and tattoos, and regarded as the least suitable people in management, and disrespectful of management, and generally a problem. I mean, why would you pay any attention to these people? So the ideas came from the wrong place. That's one part of it. But the other is that this is such a huge change. This is a fundamental change. Everything that these business schools have been teaching for 100 years is basically in saying that doesn't work anymore. And so people have written textbooks, people have courses, people have accreditation programs and built on these courses and textbooks. All of this huge paraphernalia has resulted in a change. And what's more, there's money involved. I was talking to the dean of one school and said, well, why don't you do more? And he agrees completely that they should be doing with it. But he says, I mean, we are the cash cow of the university. And a lot of the students we have come from overseas, and what they're looking for is a traditional MBA, Master of Business Administration. And if I were to start saying, no, we're not going to have that, and we're throwing all that out, and we are now going to teach a new 21st century management, that might put in question the cash cow of the university. So that is defended. The existing curriculum is defended as strongly as Fort Knox, and he is totally unable to make any change in it. So this is a rather dispiriting scene on the business school front, and my guess is that they are not, haven't been the leaders and will not be the leaders in this area, that they will be laggards, but they will be forced and dragged along. And now that you have a couple of articles in Harvard Business Review saying that this is the way forward, and the fact you have 90% of, more than 90% of senior executives saying they want to do this, and McKinsey and others are pursuing it aggressively, that eventually the business schools will be forced to catch up. But maybe you have better information, but I haven't seen many signs so far that this is at the top of their agenda.
No. In fact, we're hoping at Economics for Entrepreneurs to be a source of some of that new learning about topics like Agile, that we can be a little bit faster than the business schools and a little bit better. So we're happy to take the challenge.
Well, I wish you all the luck and happy to give you whatever support you need.
I was going to say, maybe you can help us.
Yeah, be delighted to.
Good. Thank you. Well, Stephen, we've run out of time. I really, really appreciate your being here with us today. We'll link to your book, of course. And you have another book about the storytelling that you were talking about, right?
Leader's Guide to Storytelling. So that's a textbook. It is actually in a number of universities, it's a set textbook and in their leadership programs. And it does actually provide the missing chapter in all those tens of thousands of leadership books. Well, what do you actually say Monday morning? You're facing a disgruntled group of employees or a boss who doesn't like what you're about to say. What do you actually say that not only gets that person to accept what you're saying, but to embrace it and become a champion of it? This is a practical book about how to do this. And I did this when I was in the World Bank. I stumbled upon this, and having stumbled upon it, I then found that it was hugely useful, and I've shown hundreds of workshops with Fortune 500 companies about how to use this ancient power of storytelling for some very modern purposes. So it's an exciting field, and it's being used in Agile, obviously, to get executives and staff and everyone else to understand what this is about and become champions of it.
Good. Well, we'll link to that, Steve, and let me get deeply into it as well, and maybe you could come back and tell us about storytelling when we're smart enough to ask good questions about it.
Be delighted.
Good. Well, thank you so much again for today. We got a lot of value out of this. I'm sure our listeners will love it as well, and we look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Great. All the best.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out hunterhastings.com.